typical moral Islamic civilization. All
sure.
of us.
Sure, sure,
all
absolutely.
Of us.
All of us.
Every part of
Sunni,
of
Shia, everybody. Everybody's involved in this.
Those living in the Muslim majority.
Yeah, this is a big
Africa,
project.
Asia, you know, wherever.
Yeah.
Those living in non-Muslim countries who, you know, consider their primary existential reality and identity as being Muslim and not other things.
Sure.
Or those other things as being, you know, secondary to that. You know, that's your job right now. That's our job right now.
Absolutely.
We have to build Islamic civilization, and it has to be a beautiful one. And it can't be the Takfiri, you know, organ-eating one.
No, it can't be. No, no. I don't fancy eating anybody else's liver right now, yeah.
And it can't be the Turkish, Jordanian, you know, slaves and servants of America and Israel. Mm. Okay?
Yeah.
You get it?
Yes,
you see where
absolutely.
I'm going with this?
I'm going along with
it
this.
Be the, it can't be the Al Saud, you know, authoritarian dictatorship, you know, passing it from one brother to the next, you know.
No, no. I mean, these are tyrannies. You know, these are tyrannies.
Can't be Islamic.
No, I mean, these are tyrannies. They've got to be got rid of. This has got to go in the past. It's got to go into the dustbin of history.
What it is that beautiful Islam has. Imam taught us,
yes.
as the Supreme Leader has been teaching us for these years, of how to stay on the Sirat al-Mustaqim.
Yes, on the path of righteousness.
You know,
yes.
extreme on the left, not becoming extreme on the right.
No, no.
Right?
Absolutely.
Focusing on knowledge, focusing on education,
wisdom.
Focusing on wisdom, focusing on, you know, building societies.
Absolutely.
Focusing on all these things that we see that this is what, you know, the you know, beauty is something that is fitra. Again, it goes back to fitra.
Yes.
You know, human beings recognize beauty immediately. Mm. You don't have to explain it to
no,
them.
No, you don't. No. This is something okay. part of their fitra.
Mm. When you look at a society like Iran, which went from being a, you know, feudalistic society, majority illiterate, you know, 50 years ago, to a society where the youth are all, you know, capable and educated and, you know, on the forefront of all these different things, who are conscious, who understand the world. I mean, isn't this beautiful? Isn't this what you want for your children?
Exactly. Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, I'm afraid once again, you know, time is against us, but, you know, we've run out of time on the program. But thank you very much indeed for that enlightening contribution to, you know, the life and times of Imam Khomeini. And of course, we'll be speaking much more in the future about this great man, I think, you know, for all time to come. I mean, this was a personality beyond time. How can I put it? You know, I don't have the words even to express that as far as Imam Khomeini is concerned. May God bless his soul. But thanks once again, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And it just leaves me to say for our listeners, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I hope you benefited from the program. May God's mercy and his blessings be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
And welcome back to The Light. Australia is offering environmentally friendly kayak tours in Sydney Harbour to both entertain participants and help clean up the ocean. The tours offer paddles, buckets, sieves and picker sticks for removing trash from the harbour. Each month about 20 such tours take place. they collect around 200 kilograms of garbage. Organizers believe big changes can be made with these tiny steps.
I do feel like we make a difference. It's not, I don't feel like it's just about the rubbish that we pick up, but I feel like it's about sharing a message of what we're doing, and I guess teaching people about recycling, using less plastic. I think a lot of people walk around the boardwalk and think that Sydney Harbour is beautiful and pristine, and it is a very clean waterway compared to others in the world, but once you're down here in a kayak or if you go for a swim, you really notice just how much rubbish is down there, so I think it opens people's eyes up.
Plastic pollution has a direct and deadly effect on wildlife. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, 8 million tons of plastic goes into the ocean globally each year. Experts say that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the ocean. An annual light festival lights up the Danish capital, Copenhagen, bringing color and life to the city amid the coronavirus pandemic. Architectural lighting, designs and pieces have adorned the city in the winter season, attracting many visitors. Some 30 light installations are located in and around the city, spreading under bridges, buildings and squares. The organizers have planned two routes, each 3 kilometers long, so visitors can enjoy the festival while practicing social distancing.
A light festival in these dark times is very nice. It's some brightness in your life. You get stimulated through the art. And
this is the fourth year the Copenhagen Light Festival is taking place. However, this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, guided tours, talks and pop-up events have been cancelled. Instead, the organizers have prepared an interactive map so visitors can find routes and information about the installations.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of a panda is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to 5 giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming used a clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
The German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Bilal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
A 70-year-old English grandfather has become the oldest person to row across the Atlantic unassisted. Frank Rothwell broke the world record by completing the 3,000-mile journey in 56 days. Frank rowed from Tenerife in Spain's Canary Islands to Antigua. Such a feat had never been achieved by anyone as old. The septuagenarian sailed across the Atlantic with the aim of raising awareness about Alzheimer's disease and raising £1 million for a UK dementia research charity.
In the UK and other places, I've done a lot of sailing. I've sailed around the world. I've been here 3 or 4 times, sitting in my own yacht. I've sailed around north of America to within 900 miles of the North Pole. I've sailed around South America, around Cape Horn. I'm the only man in the world to sail all the way around America in a figure of eight. Nobody in the world has ever done that except me. There's only 10 people in the world, only 10 people ever sailed all the way around America. And I'm number 10, or I was 2 years ago. I've not looked up since.
Rothwell has sailed all over the world, including 3 previous journeys across the Atlantic. In 2017, he also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This shows that to be 70 years young is sometimes far more lively than to be 40 years old.
Well, no matter how old you are, music can always be mesmerizing. In France, a pianist is still addicted to the soft tune of her instrument at the age of 106. Here's more. Colette Mays is a pianist based in Paris. She was born before the start of the First World War and has been playing her favorite instrument for more than a century now. Colette has already released 5 music albums and is now recording her 6th one. The veteran musician says what attracted her to music was a desire for tenderness, which she lacked as a kid at her strict home environment.
In my family, I was raised by a very kind nanny. Mother was very strict. That's how it was at the time, and so I needed tenderness, which was normal. Above where we lived, there were lots of little boys who played the piano. They were always playing the same music. And as a baby, with one finger, I reproduced those melodies. My parents were surprised with that, because playing with dolls didn't amuse me, but playing notes on the piano did. That's why they made me start learning the piano early on.
Well, Colette's favorite musicians are Debussy, Chopin, and Schumann. She looks at the sky for inspiration and says music is more important to her than food. For most of her adult life, Colette has been a supporting piano player at Parisian schools. The dedicated pianist is still marvelously healthy at the age of 106.
Madagascar is the land of outlandish creatures. Biologists have made another tiny discovery in the north of the island. Scientists say Bruchesia nana could be the world's smallest reptile. Also known as nanochameleon, the diminutive lizard measures less than an inch in length. That means it is as small as a sunflower seed and can fit on your fingertip. The reptilian may be tiny, but it has raised a lot of questions as to why it is this small compared to other vertebrates. Also, unlike most reptiles, female nanochameleons are larger than the males. The species is thought to be critically endangered due to mass deforestation.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Thank you. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The White House has announced that President Joe Biden intends to shut down the notorious U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay by the time he leaves office, a tall task that the Obama administration failed to achieve nearly a decade ago. The Biden administration press secretary, Jen Psaki, said recently that it was the intention of the Biden administration to shutter the offshore prison, which was set up in January of 2002 to hold people suspected of ties to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in the wake of the suspicious 11th of September 2001 attacks. We present you an article written jointly by Matt Spetelnik, Trevor Honeycutt, and Phil Stewart. The piece is titled, Can Biden Remove Guantanamo's Stain from U.S. Rights Record? The article has been taken from the Reuters news agency. The White House confirmed on Friday, 12th of February, that President Joe Biden's aides have launched a formal review of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, reviving the Obama-era goal of closing the controversial facility with the aim of doing so before Biden leaves office. Two people familiar with the matter told Reuters news agency that aides involved in internal discussions are considering an executive action to be signed by Joe Biden in coming weeks or months, signaling a purported new effort to remove what human rights advocates have called a stain on America's global image. Asked whether President Biden would shut the high-security prison located at Guantanamo Bay Naval Station by the time his presidency ends, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed, "That certainly is our goal and our intention. But such an initiative is unlikely to bring down the curtain anytime soon on the offshore facility, due largely to the steep political and legal obstacles that also frustrated the so-called efforts by his ex-boss, former President Barack Obama, to shut down Guantanamo. Set up to house foreign suspects following the suspicious 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington, the prison came to symbolize the excesses of the U.S. so-called war on terrorism because of harsh interrogation methods and torture that has been used extensively at the prison." National Security Council spokeswoman Emily Horn said, "We are undertaking an NSC process to assess the current state of play that the Biden administration has inherited from the previous administration, in line with our broader goal of closing down Guantanamo." The National Security Council spokeswoman, Emily Horn, added, "The National Security Council, NSC, will work closely with the Department of Defense, with the Department of State, and the Justice Department to make progress towards closing down the Guantanamo facility, and also in close consultation with U.S. Congress." The immediate impact of a new approach could be to reinstate, in some form, Barack Obama's Guantanamo closure policy, which was reversed by Donald Trump as soon as he took office in January of 2017. Donald Trump kept the prison open during his 4 years in the White House. Now 40 prisoners remain at Guantanamo, most held for nearly 2 decades, without being charged or even tried. Joe Biden's campaign claimed during the 2020 presidential race that he continued to support closing down the detention center, but did not say how he would do it. It is also unclear how specific Biden's coming executive action might be about his plans for the prison, which holds suspects in the suspicious 9/11 attacks among its detainee population. Signaling that deliberations are still at an early stage, Emily Horn added, a number of key policy roles still need to be filled, including ones at the Defense Department, the Pentagon, at the State Department, and at the Department of Justice. Emily Horn claimed, we need to have the right people seated to do this important work. Opened under President George W. Bush, the prison's population grew to a peak of about 800 inmates before it started to shrink. Barack Obama whittled down the number of prisoners further with his effort to close the prison, but that effort was stymied largely by Republican opposition in the Congress. The federal government is still barred by law from transferring any inmates to prisons on mainland United States. Even with his own Democratic Party now controlling Congress, their majorities are so slim that Joe Biden would face a tough challenge securing legislative changes because some Democrats might also oppose them. According to the people familiar with the matter, a revived Guantanamo strategy is expected to focus initially on further decreasing the number of prisoners held at the facility by repatriating them or finding other countries willing to accept them. The sources said this could also mean re-establishing a State Department post of Guantanamo closure envoy, created by Barack Obama but eliminated by Donald Trump, to resume negotiations with other governments on detainee transfers. The sources added, in addition, the Pentagon could restart a parole-style review process of prisoners' cases to determine whether, as the U.S. officials claiming, they still pose a threat. Still, any closure plan could initially be hampered by the coronavirus pandemic, making moving prisoners unlikely for now. Just over 3 weeks after taking office, the Biden administration has not made Guantanamo one of its top early priorities as it grapples with the coronavirus pandemic and the economic fallout from the pandemic. Barack Obama made closing Guantanamo one of his first executive orders in 2009, but failed to do so by the end of his second term in office. Andrea Prasso, Deputy Washington Director for Human Rights Watch, says, while I'm glad to hear that the new administration will be reviewing policy with an eye towards closing down Guantanamo, it's concerning that it is coming so late in the game. Shutting the facility has been a purported demand of progressive Democrats whose support helped Joe Biden win the White House. Critics say the prison's continued existence is a reminder of detention practices that opened the United States to charges of torture and abuse. Privately, administration officials expressed skepticism about getting the support they will need from U.S. Congress. America's new Defense Secretary Lord Austin's statement during his January confirmation hearing that the new administration would seek Guantanamo's closure through a letter of rebuke signed by 7 Republican House members, all military veterans. U.S. Representative Mike Waltz, one of the signatories of the letter, in a tweet claimed, if we release these Guantanamo detainees, they'll become rock stars in the extremist world, posing an even greater threat to America and to the world. Of the prisoners who remain at Guantanamo, 9 have been charged or convicted by military commissions. The most notorious is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the accused September 11 mastermind. About 24 prisoners have not been charged, but have been deemed too dangerous to release. 6 inmates have previously been cleared for release by a government panel, yet remain in prison with no arrangements for their transfer. The Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, also known as Gitmo, became synonymous with prisoner abuse by the United States in the early years of the so-called War on Terror because of harsh interrogation methods that human rights advocates said amounted to torture. The administration of former President George W. Bush had selected Guantanamo, a desolate place near the eastern tip of Cuba, because it was under full control of the U.S. military and relatively close to the U.S. mainland, but beyond the reach of American courts of law. The idea was that if the detainees, who were being captured and transferred in droves from Afghanistan and from elsewhere, were held away from U.S. soil, they would have no legal right to seek a judge's order of habeas corpus, which provides protection against unlawful imprisonment. The Guantanamo detainees were subjected to abuse, to humiliation and to torture as part of their interrogations, the accounts of which were gradually exposed to the outside world by the few inspectors who visited the prison and some of the inmates themselves who were later released. Critics say Guantanamo's continued existence is a reminder to the world of harsh interrogation practices and torture methods used by the United States that former President Barack Obama once admitted were a stain on our border record. The renewed push to close down the prison is seen as a so-called attempt by the Biden administration to remove that stain from America's global image. More than 100 human rights organizations signed a letter to Joe Biden earlier this month, calling on him to shut down Guantanamo and end the indefinite detention of suspects held in the maximum security prison. According to the open letter, Guantanamo continues to cause escalating and profound damage to the men who still languish there, and the approach it exemplifies continues to fuel and justify bigotry, stereotyping, and stigma. It remains to be seen whether the new Biden administration can overcome the obstacles and make good on Joe Biden's promise to close the notorious prison once and for all.
The world is curious about the future direction of the relationship between China and the United States. Tensions between the two major strategic rivals skyrocketed under former U.S. President Donald Trump. The former president seemed very proud of his tough line on the world's second largest economy. He launched a trade war against China and blamed it for starting the devastating COVID-19 pandemic. Now his successor, Joe Biden, is still reviewing America's strategy towards its number one rival. This week, he announced a Defense Department review of its China strategy as part of a broader effort to decide how his team will deal with Beijing. Now a newly formed task force at the U.S. Department of Defense will study the military strategy regarding China in different areas. Biden does not seem to have any illusions about the formidable challenges posed by the Chinese. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to lead an international effort to pressure, isolate, and punish China. This week, in his first phone call with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, Biden tried to press his counterpart on several issues, including trade practices, Hong Kong, and ongoing tensions with Taiwan. The American president underscored his fundamental concerns, but the Chinese president told his U.S. counterpart that he hoped Washington would approach matters of sovereignty and territorial integrity cautiously. She warned that confrontation would be disastrous for both sides.
There is a significant lack of trust on the part of both sides. Nobody's going to rush into anything at this moment under pressing conditions. But if they can find some individual items in which they can cooperate, COVID obviously is one of the areas which are affecting both countries.
The United States has been trying hard to contain China in terms of economy and military power. Such efforts were intensified over the past years, but fulfilling that goal is proving to be increasingly difficult, with China's military might increasing and its economy expanding despite the pandemic that has battered the American economy. Some estimates show that China will overtake the U.S. and become the world's largest economy sometime in this decade. This is undoubtedly keeping the Americans on the edge. These concerns were echoed by U.S. President Joe Biden this week. During a meeting with a bipartisan group of senators soon after his phone call with the Chinese leader, Biden issued a stark warning. If we don't get moving, they're going to eat our lunch. Biden warned that the Chinese are investing very heavily to deal with a whole range of issues, including transportation and the environment. The American president said the U.S. just has to immediately step up infrastructure spending. How will Biden try to counter China? Is there any room left for cooperation? Chinese officials insist that there is still a possibility.
It's kind of a light at the end of what will probably be a very long tunnel if we are to repair the U.S.-China relationship. But I think that the statement made by President Biden in his foreign policy address, which was also pretty hard-hitting with regard to China, but nevertheless, he said that they will cooperate in those issues which are in the interest of the United States. And then, of course, the call prior to the very important Spring Festival, I think sent a very good signal to the Chinese that maybe there was a way to create some kind of a new connection between the U.S. and China.
But will America move to reduce tensions? U.S. officials have said there would be no quick moves to remove tariffs on Chinese imports. The White House could even impose new targeted restrictions on sensitive technology exports to China. Experts say under Biden, the two sides will probably find a pathway to stabilize their relationship, but neither side will budge on key issues.
When former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, it also withdrew from any right of comment as to the ongoing agreement, meaning that in order for the U.S. to reconsider joining the accord, it must abide by the terms and conditions of the original plan and respect the wishes of the incumbent members. Yet with Donald Trump now out of the picture, current U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed an interest in rejoining the JCPOA, as demonstrated by his selection of advisors and foreign policy chiefs. However, Iran has warned the 46th president that the time frame for having the right to rejoin the table is fast running out as the window of opportunity tightens on the US. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, specified that certain events and circumstances in Iran meant that should the US not hasten its act in showing genuine intention of rejoining the JCPOA, it may find that the door firmly shuts behind it, leaving the US out of the cold when it comes to the agreement. And this was reiterated by Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Zarif went on to explain that should Biden continue to demonstrate cold feet when making the first move by totally lifting the US-imposed sanctions on Iran, then he could risk tarnishing his name with the same brush as Donald Trump, hence failing to shake off the Trump legacy and creating a new one of his own. However, the United States Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, suggested it was for Iran to take the first step. However, this rationale defies all logic because, as mentioned, by withdrawing from the JCPOA under Trump, the US, or for that matter, any other non-member of the Accord, have no right to comment or suggest what steps should be taken, with the onus of good faith actually placed on their shoulders to prove that their intentions are genuine, rather than vice versa. Iran has seen itself grow as a nation over the last 42 years since the overthrow of the Pahlavi regime in the 1979 Islamic Revolution. It fought an 8-year war against Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, overcame multiple challenges, and proved itself to be a regional player across a host of fields. Yet as Iran recently celebrated the 42 years of the Islamic Revolution, it's also worth taking a moment to analyze just how Iran has been able to demonstrate self-sufficiency, even during the toughest of times. With sanctions aimed at crippling Iran's economic power, Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure policy failed miserably as Iran stood up to the challenge, showing how in spite of the best attempts by Trump to break the country from within, the people of the nation still stood firm and proud against the economic terrorism imposed by Trump, with the Iranian foreign minister blaming Trump's failure on his incompetent advisors.
I believe President Trump, unfortunately, does not have good advisors. He's been waiting for Iranian government's collapse since he withdrew from the nuclear deal. At that time, John Bolton promised him that maximum pressure will bring us to our knees within a few months.
Furthermore, Iran has also demonstrated its regional and global intentions in its successful defeat of the US-backed Daesh terrorist group, led by the skill and strategy of martyred Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, proving to the world that Iran is a force for peace around the world. With too many achievements to name, Iran has demonstrated to the world that it's a nation that complies with international law and regulations, as well as showing that it can stand up to the bullies and agitators in the region who try to destabilize the security of the area, hence raising the question as to just why Iran should be the ones that take the first step to invite the US back to the JCPOA table. The polar opposite is true for the United States, who have over the last 4 years done nothing more than demonstrate their warmongering and state-sponsored aggression to the world, hence raising doubt as to whether Joe Biden's intentions to rejoin the JCPOA are actually genuine at all. With palaces, country residents, land and real estate, the Windsor family of Britain are one of the wealthiest in the country, and their royal rule comes as part and parcel of the British establishment. However, yet another dark side of the royal family has emerged, this time surrounding their personal wealth and investments. A report by investigative journalist published in the Guardian newspaper has revealed that Queen Elizabeth lobbied the then government of Edward Heath to change a law in order to hide her private wealth. The deal, which was agreed between the governments of Heath and Wilson, allowed the British state to create a state-backed shell company, which was designed to place a veil of secrecy over the royals' wealth, which, had the value have been leaked, would have been very embarrassing for the Windsors. With the majority of British people in the 1970s living in hardship as the effects of the oil crisis and unemployment hit hard, why then did the British Queen want to hide her enormous wealth from her loyal subjects?
Of course, we have to remember that although the story is new, it's actually really dates back to the 1970s, just now that the relevant government documents have been released, and that so the Guardian was able to cover the story. And at that time, the Queen was very anxious that her private wealth be a secret, that people shouldn't know how much she was worth. She was estimated to be the richest woman in the world at the time. But that is no longer the case. But certainly they would have felt at that time in the 1970s that the wish for secrecy was justified. But in today's world, it's very different. We expect much greater transparency.
With the law proposed to Heath, yet passed by his successor, Harold Wilson, the Queen's assets were quickly passed into the shell company, hence removing immediate layers of traceable wealth to the Queen, and remained in place until at least 2011. The ability for the Queen to pass such laws comes from an ancient law called the Queen's Consent, and evidence suggests that this law was used as far back as 1728. Yet, by applying this law in the 1970s, and now even in modern days, unknown to the public, the law breaks the norm of the monarchy respecting government independence, suggesting the royal family are not as transparent and clear as they portray to be. Britain, and in particular the royal family, are in fact the polar opposite of what a democracy should be, with an unelected royal family who rule by air and not consent, and a government that has on many occasions won an election with a minority vote. One has to question just how free Britain really is. With the ultra elite being so readily able to hide their wealth, does this mean that such acts can be applied to the wider political spectrum? After all, if it's good enough for the goose, it's good enough for the gander.
There's been quite a lot of dismay in among the British public recently about the way the government has been handing billions of pounds of public money used for PPE in the COVID crisis and also for the awards of contracts for people for search and trace, for example, track and trace. And really the problem today is that we don't know who exactly is getting the money. We know the amounts of money involved, but there's a great deal of secrecy about how many of these people are or companies linked to individuals who are in the government or who are donors to the ruling Conservative Party.
Yet there are some in Britain who have defended the Queen, in particular from the biased and pro-British establishment Daily Express newspaper, whose columnist Richard Kay stated that the evidence supplied by the Guardian newspaper is, quote, hardly compelling, and he fails to believe that the Queen conspired with the government to hide her wealth. Whereas the story will unlikely rock the popularity of the royal family amongst the hardcore British faithful, the fact that the story has emerged shows that there are people in Britain who are willing to dig up the truth and seek to expose the royal family for who they really are. With Britain at one of its lowest ever points since World War II, and with COVID-19 tearing the economy and lives apart, as well as the impact of Brexit now being felt in a way Britain would not care to admit, as cries of nationalism and independence echo across the United Kingdom and the north of Ireland, one can only wonder just what else the Queen has tried to hide from law, as she tries in vain to hold together not only her estranged family, but her entire country and legacy in the process.
On Sunday, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, reiterated Iran's position that it will reverse its scale back of commitments under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal only after the United States goes back to full compliance with the international accord. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Iran will first verify that all sanctions are lifted, not on paper or by words, but in action, and then will restore its commitments to the deal. The remarks come as Iran and United States seem to have reached a standoff, with both asking the other to act first to salvage the nuclear agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. This is while the United States under former President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from the accord in May 2018 and imposed sanctions on Iran as part of its so-called maximum pressure campaign. Tehran, however, remained fully compliant with the deal for an entire year. But as the remaining European parties failed to fulfill their end of the bargain, Iran began in May 2019 to scale back some of its JCPOA commitments in several steps under Articles 26 and 36 of the accord covering Tehran's legal rights.
Returning to the deal provides a lot of gains for everybody on both sides and the rest of the world for reality. And for Iran, it means lifting of all the sanctions that have harmed the economy and the medical health of the population living a pandemic. For the United States, it will mean that there will be less possibility of confrontation with Iran, that there's possibilities of creating a more stable region. But looking at how the United States, its main interest in the region is to control it and its resources, this is probably why some of the United States and its local vessels like Apartheid Israel and Saudi Arabia are not really happy with the deal, because it's in their interest to have conflict where the region's resources can be extracted.
Iran has time and again noted that these steps are reversible if all parties to the nuclear deal go back to strict compliance with their obligations. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif warned that the clock is ticking for the U.S., referring to the Iranian parliament's legislation passed late last year that demands a further expansion to Iran's scale-back within a three-month time frame, as well as the upcoming Iranian presidential election. Biden said on Sunday that the U.S. won't lift sanctions on Iran first.
Will the U.S. lift sanctions first in order to get Iran back to the negotiating table?
No.
They have to stop enriching uranium first.
This is while reports show the Biden administration is mulling easing some sanctions without lifting key ones as a step toward reviving the JCPOA. Sources familiar with the matter say the options include those based on humanitarian grounds, such as providing backing for International Monetary Fund lending to Tehran for coronavirus relief.
Right now, the United States is refusing to do what is just, which is to go back to the deal that it broke and it moved out of, and lift the sanctions for then Iran to return to its obligations. And we heard today Mr. President Biden saying that they have no intention of taking basically the first move. That the United States is expecting Iran to get back to its obligations, and obviously that means the United States has not accepted that it violated the treaty.
But Iran's position is clear: no going back to full compliance unless all parties to the deal are back on track.
You. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The lack of critical coverage of Biden's new announcement suggests that corporate media will no longer be as concerned about kids in cages. Now the preferred candidate is in the White House, says Alan McLeod, a writer, in an article published under the heading "From Concentration Camps to Overflow Facilities." With Biden in charge, media forgets kids in cages. Stay tuned for the details, please. The Biden administration is opening a new child prison along the United States-Mexico border. The center, located in Carrizo Springs, around 100 miles southwest of San Antonio, is being specifically built for unaccompanied migrant children attempting to cross the border and will hold around 700 people when finished, although plans noted it will be expanded if the government deems it necessary. But corporate media do not see it that way. While the Trump years were filled with stories about kids in cages and ICE concentration camps along the border, they have instead almost universally referred to the new project as an overflow facility, to help my grandchildren, as the following headlines demonstrate. For example, CNN says, Biden administration prepares to open overflow facility for migrant children. Or New York Post says, Biden administration to open overflow facility for 700 migrant children. USA Today says, Biden administration to house migrant teens at overflow facility in Texas closed under Trump. Or Yahoo News says, Biden administration to open migrant overflow facility amid increase in unaccompanied migrant apprehensions. CBS says, Biden administration prepares to open overflow facility for migrant children. Overflow facility is a distinctly pleasantly sounding term for such an establishment, suggesting links to positively charged services like swimming pools or libraries. The phrase is a completely new way to refer to prisons. A new search for overflow facility pre-January 2021 brings up only stories about COVID overflow clinics or emergency sewage treatment works. The phrase concentration camp to describe the structure was completely absent. Perhaps the worst offender, however, was Fox News, whose headline informed the readers, Biden administration to open overflow shelter for migrant children in Texas, a framing that invites the audience to see the move as a humanitarian gesture along the lines of rape crisis shelters. None of the children who will be sent there will go of their own free will, and it is doubtful whether many will appreciate the shelter that the U.S. government will provide them. Over much of the past 3 years, corporate media have been comparing the detention centers on the border to concentration camps, if not directly labeling them as such. For example, CNN, Esquire, Washington Post. Data from Google Trends show that phrases like ICE concentration camp will barely used until 2018, the term exploding into public consciousness a year later, especially after prominent Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez began using it. President Biden has promised to rein in many of the worst excessive ICE policy, yet the organization's role in society will not fundamentally change. Indeed, during the time he was vice president, President Obama deported well over 2.5 million people through immigration orders, more than any other president in American history, earning him the moniker Deporter-in-Chief from critics. President Trump actually deported fewer migrants than Obama, although he drastically sharpened his rhetoric against them and encouraged ICE to carry out a campaign of intimidation against the population nationwide and attempting to prosecute activists who helped migrants survive the perilous desert crossing. And while Trump politicized and made the border wall a central part of his administration, hundreds of miles of the wall had already been built by previous presidents, as filmmaker Abby Martin documented. Missing from so much of the coverage, whether pro or anti-border wall, however, is the context to why so many people are leaving Central America to go northwards in the first place. When corporate media do offer explanations, they have been relatively shallow, merely noting that they are searching for employment, fleeing discrimination, or following a dream. In reality, economic and political factors largely account for the enormous migration, many of which have been their origins in decisions taken in Washington, D.C. Free trade deals signed with developing countries such as NAFTA decimated local agriculture, as a small-scale farmer suddenly had to compete with massive U.S. government-subsidized agribusiness, leading to a collapse in the Mexican rural economy and a huge influx of people into the country's largest cities. Meanwhile, the Obama administration's decision to overthrow the government of Honduras in 2009 led to a military dictatorship, persecution on a national scale, and a mass exodus from the country. In neighboring Nicaragua, by comparison, the U.S. has tried but failed to remove the Sandinista government. As a result, emigration from Nicaragua has been minimal. The lack of critical coverage of Biden's new announcement suggests that corporate media will no longer be as concerned about kids in cages. Now, their preferred candidate is in the White House. Perhaps they never cared at all.
Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979 was a monumental event in many aspects, with long-lasting effects still felt to this day. Let's take a look at how this movement, whose seeds were sown at the turn of the 20th century, sprung up and rose to defeat colonialism. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. To better understand the roots of Iran's Islamic Revolution, we have to go back in time to the beginning of the 20th century. This is when the British Empire was at its height, with around a quarter of the world's entire population under its rule and around a quarter of the Earth's landmass under its dominion. At this time, the British were occupying India, Australia, Canada, and vast swaths of Africa. One place that wasn't officially part of the empire, but in practical terms very much under its rule, is in fact Iran, with the Russian Empire occupying the northern part of Iran and the British exerting their sphere of influence over the southern part of Iran. Now, as with many imperialist endeavors, a lot of the story has to do with natural resources, particularly oil. In 1908, oil was discovered in Iran. A British company known back then as Burma Oil founded a subsidiary company called the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. This Anglo-Persian Oil Company installed its first pipeline just 1 year later in 1909 and built an enormous refinery in Abadan, which was completed later in 1912. And from that moment on, this company in Britain effectively began stealing oil from the Iranian people for the next decades. Former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, at the time, was First Lord of the Admiralty and in charge of the British Royal Navy. He realized what a lucrative gold mine this was. He convinced the British government to buy an ownership share in the Anglo-Persian Oil Company in 1914, and he transitioned the Royal Navy's fleets from coal to petroleum, which proved to be of immense use in World War I and World War II, when the British Navy was the envy of other empires at the time. The British, however, took the Iranians for granted and gave them crumbs. Iran received a mere 16% of all oil revenue for its own oil. If that wasn't bad enough, this tiny amount of 16% was calculated by the United Kingdom's government in private without ever showing the Iranians the books. And on top of that, this was done after taxes had already been paid by the British government to the British government. This blatant theft and plundering of Iran's natural resources became common.